Can nobody help? There aren't a lot of people around who have a spare £108,000 for a worthless bunch of shares. Would you like me to come with you when you go and see Archie? Elizabeth asked, rising from her seat. No, darling, it's kind of you to ask, but I'm the one who made such a fool of myself. Elizabeth leaned over and pushed back the hair that had fallen over his forehead. She couldn't help noticing some grey strands that must have appeared in the last few weeks. We'll just have to live off my salary while you look for a job. Simon drove slowly down to Pocklebridge to keep his impromptu appointment with the chairman. Archie Milburn, standing hands on hips in his garden, listened to the tale with a sad face.
It's been happening to a lot of good people in the city lately, but what I can't understand is, if the company owns such prime properties, why has no one made a takeover bid? Sounds as if it's an asset stripper's dream.
It appears to be a matter of confidence, said Simon.
A sacred word in the city, agreed Archie, while he continued to prune his Roosevelts and red mistresses.
Simon handed him the prepared letter of resignation, which Milburn read over and reluctantly accepted.
I won't mention this to anyone until you've seen the Chief Whip on Monday. I'll call a special meeting of the full committee on Tuesday evening and inform them of your decision then. You'd better be prepared for an unfriendly barrage from the press on Tuesday night.
The two men shook hands.
Your misfortune is our misfortune, said Archie. In a very short time, you've gained the respect and the affection of the local people. You'll be missed.
Simon drove back to London. And although the car radio was on low, he didn't take in the news flash that they kept repeating every 30 minutes. Chapter 20. Raymond was among the first to hear the announcement, and was stunned by it. Harold Wilson was going to resign less than halfway through the 5-year parliament, and for no apparent reason other than that he had just passed his 60th birthday. He proposed to remain Prime Minister only so long as the Labour Party took to select its new leader. Raymond and Kate sat glued to the television, picking up every scrap of information they could. They discussed the implications far into the night.
Well, Carrot Top, could this mean rehabilitation for our forgotten hero?
Who can say?
Well, if you can't, who can?
The next leader, said Raymond.
The fight for the leadership was a straight battle between the left and right wings of the party, James Callaghan on the right and Michael Foot on the left. Andrew and Raymond both wanted the same man, and it was with some relief that they saw Callaghan, despite losing the first ballot, come through to be elected leader. The Queen duly called for Callaghan and asked him to form a new administration. As tradition demands, Andrew sent his resignation to Downing Street, as did every other member of the government, to allow the new Prime Minister to select his own team. Raymond was in court listening to the judge's summing up when his junior passed him a note. Please call 10 Downing Street as soon as possible. The judge took a further 30 minutes, meticulously explaining to the jury the legal definition of manslaughter, before Raymond could escape. He ran down the corridor and stopped at one of the clerk's private boxes to make the call. The plastic dial rotating back into place after each number seemed to take forever. After he had been passed through three people, a voice said,
Good afternoon, Ray.
The unmistakable, gravelly tones of the new Prime Minister.
I think it's time you rejoin the government.
Raymond held his breath.
As Minister of State at the Department of Trade.
Minister of State. Only one place away from the Cabinet.
You still there, Ray?
Yes, Prime Minister, and I'd be delighted to accept. He put the phone down, immediately picked it up again, and dialed the city office of the Chase Manhattan Bank. They put him through to the Eurobond manager. Andrew had left his desk at the Home Office and returned to Cheyne Walk. He stayed away from the House of Commons, where the lobby correspondents were hanging about like hyenas, scampering off to phone their papers with even a rumour of a rumour. The new cabinet had been selected, and now it was the turn of the ministers of state. All Andrew knew for certain was that his old job at the Home Office had been given to someone else. "Why don't you go and play football with Robert?" Louise suggested, "and stop moping around under my feet."
"Yes, Dad, yes, Dad, yes, Dad,"
demanded his son, running upstairs to reappear a few minutes later, dressed in the Liverpool kit that he had bought himself from 11 weeks' hard-saved pocket money.
"Go on, Andrew. I can always call you if the phone goes."
Andrew smiled, took off his jacket and put on the pair of old gym shoes Robert was holding out for him. He followed his 5-year-old son into the garden to find him already dribbling up and down the thin strip between the flower beds. The little goal he had bought for Robert, or was it for himself, at Christmas, was already set up at the far end of the grass, and they took turns defending it. Andrew always had to start in goal. He rubbed his hands together to keep warm as Robert dribbled toward him. He came out of the goal ready to stifle a shot, but Robert kicked the ball to the right and ran to the left, leaving his father spread-eagled on the ground before he pushed the ball gently into the goal.
"That's called a feint,"
he shouted triumphantly as he ran back past his prostrate father. Andrew picked himself up.
"I know what it's called," he said, laughing. "You seem to have forgotten who taught you the feint in the first place. Let's see if you can do it twice running," he added, returning to defend the goal.
Robert dribbled away from his father until he reached the end of the garden, then turned to face him again. He had begun advancing towards the goal for a second time when there was the sound of the phone ringing. Andrew looked towards the house just as Robert kicked the ball, which, rising sharply, struck him in the face. He and the ball fell back into the goal mouth. Louise opened the kitchen window and shouted,
"It's only my mother."
"Wake up, Dad,"
demanded Robert simultaneously. Andrew's face was still stinging from the blow.
"I'm going to get you for that," he said. "Your turn to defend the goal."
Robert rushed forward to take his place between the posts, jumping up and down and trying to touch the crossbar with the tip of his fingers. Andrew took his time as he moved towards his son. When he was about a yard in front of Robert, he feinted to the right and ran to the left. But Robert had seen the move coming and leaped on the ball, shouting, "No goal!" Once again, Andrew returned to the end of the garden, thinking over what move he could try next. He suddenly ran straight at Robert and kicked the ball firmly towards the right-hand corner of the goal mouth. But again, Robert anticipated the move and caught the ball above his head before pulling it to his chest and shouting,
"No goal, Dad! No goal!"
He tossed the ball confidently back along the ground to his father's feet.
"Right, the fooling around is over," said Andrew,
not quite convinced. He kicked the ball from one foot to the other, trying to look skillful.
"Come on, Dad,"
Robert complained. This time, Andrew advanced with a look of determination on his face. He tried a change of pace to make his son leave the goal mouth too early. Robert duly came out of the goal. Andrew kicked the ball a little harder and higher than his previous attempt. As he did so, he heard the phone ring again and turned his head towards the house. He didn't see his shot cannon against the left-hand corner of the goalpost and bounce away.
"It's the Prime Minister,"
shouted Louise from the window. Andrew turned to walk quickly back towards the house. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the ball bounce onto the path on its way towards the gate and into the road. Robert was already running towards the open gate.
"I'll save it, Dad! I'll save it!"
"No!"
screamed Andrew at the top of his voice, and turned back to run as fast as he could after his son. Louise froze as she stared out of the window, still holding onto the phone with her rubber gloves. She watched as Andrew turned his back and tore towards the pavement until he was only a yard behind his son. The ball bounced on into the road, and Robert dived for it a split second before his father threw himself on his son. Louise was the only one who saw the driver of the massive shell tanker slam on its brakes and swerve too late to avoid them. Andrew and Robert collided with the corner of the wide metal mudguard and were thrown back together before rolling over and over several times, ending up in the gutter.
"Are you there, Andrew?" asked the Prime Minister.
Louise dropped the phone and ran out of the kitchen towards the open gate. Her husband lay motionless beside the curb with their son in his arms, the ball still clutched against his chest. She tried to hold on to both of them as Andrew's blood poured down over Robert's red shirt and onto her rubber gloves. She fell onto her knees by the curbside.
"Let them live. Let them live,"
was all she said. Robert was crying softly as he held firmly onto the ball and stared at his unconscious father. She had to lean over to hear him repeating,
"No goal, Dad. No goal."
When the completed list of ministers was published in the Times 2 days later, the only unfilled post left was that of Minister of State for Defense. The Times' political editor, David Wood, surmised that the position was being held open for Mr. Andrew Fraser, who was expected to be out of hospital by the end of the week. Wood's final paragraph read, "Politicians from all parties joined forces in praising Mr. Fraser's remarkable courage in diving in front of a moving lorry to rescue his only son, Robert, who was chasing a football. Both father and son were rushed to St. Thomas's Hospital with internal injuries, where surgeons operated through the night to save Mr. Fraser's life. As was reported in the final edition of yesterday's paper, his 5-year-old son, Robert, died during the night before Mr. Fraser regained consciousness."
"My God," exclaimed Elizabeth. "How dreadful."
"What's dreadful?" asked Simon as he took his seat at the breakfast table. She passed the paper to her husband and pointed to the picture of Robert.
"Poor kid," said Simon before he had finished the article. "Certainly puts our own problems into perspective. If Peter or Michael were killed, we really would have something to worry about."
Neither of them spoke for several minutes. Then Elizabeth asked,
"Are you dreading it?"
"Yes, I am," said Simon. "I feel like a condemned man eating his last breakfast. And the worst part of it is that I have to drive myself to the gallows."
"I wonder if we'll ever laugh about today."
"No doubt, when I collect my parliamentary pension."
"Can we live off that?"
"Hardly. I don't get the first payment until I'm 65, so we have a 25-year wait to find out."
He got up.
"Can I give you a lift to the hospital?"
"No, thanks.
I intend to savor the joys of being a 2-car family for at least another week. Just let's hope the new marina holds its price as well as Sir Michael Edwards claimed it would."
Simon laughed, kissed his wife, and left for his appointment with the Chief Whip at the House of Commons. As he started the car, Elizabeth rushed out.
"I forgot to tell you. Ronnie phoned while you were in the bath."
"I'll call him as soon as I reach the house."
Simon made his way to the Commons. He felt sick as he passed Cheyne Walk and thought of Andrew Fraser and all he must be going through. He made a mental note to write to him immediately. At the Commons, the policeman on the gate saluted as he drove in.
"Good morning, sir,"
he said.
"Good morning," said Simon.
He parked his car on the second level of the new underground car park and took the escalator up to the members' entrance. He couldn't help reflecting that 10 years ago he would have taken the stairs. He continued through the members' cloakroom, up the marble staircase to the members' lobby. Habit had made him turn left into the little post office to check whether he had any mail.
"Mr. Carslake,"
the man behind the counter called into an intercom. and a few seconds later, a parcel and a packet of letters held together by a thick elastic band thudded into an office basket. Simon left the parcel marked London School of Economics and the letters on the desk in his room and checked his watch. Over 40 minutes before his appointment with the chief whip. He went to the nearest phone and dialed Nethercott and Company. Ronnie answered the phone himself.
"Sacked the telephone operator last Friday," he explained. "Only me and my secretary left."
"You called, Ronnie?" A millimeter of hope in Simon's voice.
"Yes. I wanted to express how I felt. I tried to write you a letter over the weekend, but I'm not very good with words."
He paused.
"Nor, it seems, with figures. I just wanted to say how desperately sorry I am. Elizabeth told me you were going to see the chief whip this morning. I'll be thinking of you."
"That's kind, Ronnie. But I went into it with my eyes wide open. As an advocate of free enterprise, I can hardly complain when I turn out to be one of its victims."
"A very philosophical attitude for this time in the morning.
How are things your end?"
"The receiver's checking the books. I still believe we can get out with all our creditors fully paid. At least that way I'll avoid the stigma of bankruptcy."
There was a longer pause.
"Ah, Christ. That was tactless."
"Don't worry about it, Ronnie. The overdraft was my decision." Simon already wished he'd been as frank with his wife.
"Let's have lunch one day next week."
"It'll have to be somewhere that takes luncheon vouchers," said Simon Riley.
"Good luck, mate," said Ronnie.
Simon decided to fill up the remaining 30 minutes at the house by going to the library and glancing over the rest of the morning press. He settled himself in a corner of the B-room next to the fireplace, over which hung a notice reminding members not to have over-loud or prolonged conversations. He leafed through the papers, which all carried photographs of Andrew Fraser and his wife and son. The same portrait of 5-year-old Robert appeared on almost every front page. Elizabeth was right. In so many respects, they were lucky. The story of the probable breakup of Nethercott and Company was detailed on the financial pages. They quoted approvingly Ronnie's view that all creditors ought to be paid in full. Not one of the articles mentioned Simon's name, but he could already anticipate the headlines in tomorrow's paper, with another picture of a young MP and his happy family. The rise and fall of Simon Karslake. Over 10 years' work, quickly forgotten, he would be old news within a week. The library clock inched towards the hour that he could no longer put off. Simon heaved himself out of the deep leather chair like an old man and walked slowly towards the chief whip's office. Miss Snorse, the chief's ancient secretary, smiled benignly as he came in.
"Good morning, Mr. Karslake," she said brightly. "I'm afraid the chief is still with Mrs. Thatcher, but I did remind him of your appointment, so I don't expect him to be long. Would you care to have a seat?"
"Thank you," he said. Alec Pimpkin always claimed that Miss Norse had a set patter for every occasion. His imitation of her saying,
"I hope I find you in rude health, Mr. Pimpkin,"
had brought chuckles to the members' dining room on many occasions. He must have exaggerated, thought Simon.
"I hope I find you in rude health, Mr. Karslake," said Miss Norse, not looking up from her typing.
Simon choked back a laugh.
"Very rude, thank you," he said, wondering how many tragic stories or tales of lost opportunities Miss Norse had had to listen to over the years.
She stopped suddenly and looked at her notepad.
"I should have mentioned it to you before, Mr. Karslake. Mr. Nethercott rang."
"Thank you, I've spoken to him already."
Simon was leafing through an out-of-date copy of Punch when the chief whip strode in.
"I can spare you 1 minute, Simon. 1.5 if you're going to resign," he said laughing, and marched off towards his office.
As Simon followed him down the corridor, the phone by Miss Norse's side rang.
"It's for you, Mr. Karslake,"
she shouted to their retreating backs. Simon turned and said, "Can you take the number?"
"He says it's urgent."
Simon stopped, hesitating. "With you in a moment," he said to the chief whip, who disappeared into his office. Simon walked back and took the phone from Miss Norse's outstretched hand. "Simon Karslake here. Who is it?"
"It's Ronnie."
"Ronnie?" said Simon flatly.
"I've just had a call from Morgan Grenfell. One of their clients has made an offer of £1.25 a share for the company, and they're willing to take over the current liabilities."
Simon was trying to do the sums in his head.
"Don't bother working it out," Ronnie said. "At £1.25, your shares will be worth £75,000.
"It won't be enough," said Simon, as he recalled his overdraft of £108,712, a figure etched in his memory.
"Don't panic. I've told them I won't settle for anything less than £1.50 a share, and it has to be within 7 days, which will give them ample time to check the books. That will bring you in £90,000, but you'd still be £18,000 down the Swanee, which you'll have to learn to live with. If you sell the wife as well as the second car, you should just about survive."
Simon could tell by the way his friend was speaking that Ronnie already had a cigar between his lips.
"You're a genius."
"Not me. Morgan Grenfell. I bet they'll make a handsome profit in the long run for their unnamed client, who seemed to have all the inside information. If you're still on for lunch next Tuesday, don't bring your luncheon vouchers. It's on me." Simon put the phone down and kissed Miss Norse on the forehead. She was completely taken aback by a situation for which she had no set reply. She remained silent as the chief whip put his head round the door.
"An orgy in the chief whip's office. You'll be on page 3 of the Sun next, Miss Norse."
Simon laughed.
"I've got a crisis on over tonight's vote. The government are reneging on our agreement for pairing. I have to get a delegation back from Brussels in time for the 10 o'clock division. Whatever it is, can it wait, Simon?"
"Yes, of course."
"Can you come to my office, Miss Norse, if I can drag you away from James 007 Karslake?"
Simon left and almost bounced to the nearest phone. First, he called Elizabeth, and then Archie Milburn at his office. Archie didn't sound all that surprised.
"Don't you think it might be wise for us to stop seeing each other?"
"Why?" said Raymond. "Palmerston had a mistress when he was 70, and he still beat Disraeli come the election."
"Yes, but that was before the days of a dozen national newspapers and investigative journalism. Frankly, it wouldn't take a Woodward or Bernstein more than a few hours to discover our little secret."
"We'll be all right. I've destroyed all the tapes."
"Do be serious."
"You're always telling me I'm far too serious."
"Well, I want you to be now. Very." Raymond turned to face Kate.
"I love you, Kate, and I know I always will. Why don't we stop this charade and get married?"
She sighed.
"We've been over this 100 times. I'll want to return to America eventually, and in any case, I wouldn't make a very good Prime Minister's wife."
"3 American women have in the past,"
said Raymond sulkily.
"To hell with your historical precedents. And what's more, I hate Leeds."
"You've never been there."
"I don't need to if it's colder than London."
"Then you'll have to be satisfied with being my mistress."
Raymond took Kate in his arms.
"You know, I used to think being Prime Minister was worth every sacrifice. But now I'm not so sure."
"It's still worth the sacrifice," said Kate, "as you'll discover when you live at number 10. Come on, or my dinner will be burned to a cinder."
"You haven't noticed these,"
said Raymond smugly, pointing down at his feet. Kate stared at the fashionable new slip-ons.
"I never thought the day would come," she said. "Pity you're starting to go bald."
When Simon returned home, his first words were, "We'll survive."
"Thank God for that," Elizabeth said. "But what have you done about your resignation letter?"
"Archie said he would return at the day I became Prime Minister."
"If that's ever to be true, I want you to promise me just one thing."
"Anything," said Simon.
"You'll never speak to Ronnie Nethercott again."
For a moment, Simon hesitated before saying, "That's not completely fair, Elizabeth, because I haven't been totally straight with you from the beginning." He then sat his wife down on the sofa and told her the whole truth. It was Elizabeth's turn to remain silent.
"Oh, hell," she said, looking up at Simon. "I do hope Ronnie can forgive me."
"What are you talking about?"
"I phoned him back soon after you'd left for the Commons, and I spent at least 10 minutes telling him why he was the biggest two-faced bastard I'd ever come across, and I didn't want to hear from him again in my life."
It was Simon's turn to collapse onto the sofa.
"How did he respond?"
he asked anxiously. Elizabeth faced her husband.
"That's the strange thing. He didn't even protest. He just apologized."
"Do you think she will ever speak again?"
"God knows. I hope so,"
said his father, staring at the picture of his grandchild on the mantelpiece.
"She's still young enough to have another child."
Andrew shook his head.
"No, that's out of the question. The doctor warned me a long time ago that that could be dangerous."
He had returned home from hospital 10 days after the accident. The first thing he and Louise did was to attend Robert's funeral. With Andrew on crutches, Sir Duncan had to support Louise during the short service. As soon as the burial was over, Andrew took his wife back to Cheney Walk and put her to bed before returning downstairs to join his parents. Andrew's mother bowed her head.
"Whatever happens, you must move from this place as soon as possible. Every time Louise looks out of that kitchen window, she'll relive the tragedy."
"I hadn't thought of that," said Andrew. "I'll start looking for a new house immediately."
"And what do you plan to do about the Prime Minister's offer?"
inquired Sir Duncan.
"I haven't finally made up my mind," he said sharply. "He's given me until Monday to come to a decision."
"You must take it, Andrew. If you don't, your political career will be finished. You can't sit at home and mourn Robert's death for the rest of your life."
Andrew looked up at his father.
"No goal, Dad. No goal," he murmured,
and left them to go and sit with Louise in the bedroom.
Her eyes were open, but there was no expression on her face. Little white hairs had appeared at either side of her head that he had not noticed the week before.
"Feeling any better, my darling?" he asked.
There was still no reply. He undressed and climbed into bed beside her, holding her close. But she did not respond. She felt detached and distant. He watched his tears fall on her shoulder and run down onto the pillow. He fell asleep and woke again at 3 in the morning. No one had closed the curtains, and the moon shone in through the windows, lighting the room. He looked at his wife. She had not moved. Charles paced up and down the room angrily.
"Give me the figures again."
"Nethercott has accepted a bid of £7,500,000, which works out at £1.50 a share," said Clive Reynolds. Charles stopped at his desk and scribbled the figures down on a piece of paper. £90,000, leaving a shortfall of only £18,000. It wouldn't be enough.
"Damn,"
he said.
I agree, said Reynolds. I always thought we were premature to lose our position in the company in the first place.
An opinion you will not voice outside this room, said Charles.
Clive Reynolds did not reply.
What's happened to Nethercott himself?
Asked Charles, searching for any scrap of information he could find about Simon Carslake.
I'm told he's starting up again in a smaller way. Morgan Grenfell were delighted by the deal and the manner in which he handled the company during the takeover. I must say we let it fall into their laps.
Can we get any stock in the new company? Asked Charles, ignoring his comment.
I doubt it. It's only capitalized at 1 million, although Morgan Grenfell are giving Nethercott a large overdraft facility as part of the deal.
Then all that remains necessary is to see the matter is never referred to again.
Andrew spent the weekend reading over the letters of condolence sent to him and Louise. There were over 1,000, many from people he didn't even know. He selected a few to take into the bedroom and read to Louise, not that he was sure she could even hear him. The doctor had told him not to disturb her unless it was really necessary. After such a severe shock, she was now suffering from acute depression and must be nursed slowly back to health. Louise had walked a few paces the previous day, but needed to rest today, the doctor explained to him. He sat by the side of their bed and quietly read the letters from the Prime Minister, from contrite Jock McPherson, from Simon Carslake, from Raymond Gould, and from Mrs. Bloxham. There was no sign that Louise had taken in anything he had said.
What shall I do about the PM's offer? He asked. Shall I accept it?
She made no response of any kind.
He's asked me to be the Minister of State for Defence, but I need to know how you would feel.
After sitting with her for a few more minutes and eliciting no response, he left her to rest. Each night he slept with her and tried to infuse her with his love, but he only felt more alone. On the Monday morning, he called his father and told him he had decided to turn down the Prime Minister's offer. He couldn't leave Louise alone for long periods while she was still in this state. Andrew returned to the bedroom and sat by her side. He said in a whisper, as if to himself, "Should I have taken the job?" Louise gave such a slight nod that Andrew nearly missed it, but her fingers were moving. He placed his hand between her fingers and palm, and she squeezed gently and repeated the nod, then fell asleep. Andrew phoned the Prime Minister. Raymond dug deeper into the red box.
You enjoying yourself, Carrot Top?
That's fascinating, said Raymond.
Do you know... No, I don't. You haven't spoken to me in the last 3 hours. And when you do, it's to tell me how you spend the day with your new mistress.
My new mistress? The Secretary of State for Trade.
Oh, him. Yes, him.
What sort of day did you have at the bank? Asked Raymond, not looking up from his papers.
I had a most fascinating day, replied Kate.
Why, what happened? One of our customers required a loan, said Kate.
A loan? Repeated Raymond, still concentrating on the file in front of him.
How much?
How much do you want? I said. How much have you got? They asked. 417 billion at the last count, I told them. That will do fine for a start with, they said. Sign here, I said. But I couldn't close the deal because the lady concerned was only in possession of a £50 banking card.
Raymond burst out laughing and slammed down the lid of the red box.
Do you know why I love you?
My taste in men's clothes? Suggested Kate.
No, no. Just your taste in men. I always thought that mistresses were supposed to get fur coats, trips to the Bahamas, the odd solitaire diamond. Yet all I ever get is to share you with your red box.
Raymond opened the box once more, took out a small package, and handed it to Kate.
What's this?
Why don't you open it and find out?
Kate slipped off the purple Asprey paper and found inside an exquisitely made miniature, a solid gold replica of a red box on a gold chain. The neat lettering on the side of the lid read, "For your eyes only."
Although they don't announce the birthdays of ministers' mistresses in the Sunday Times, I can still remember the day we met.
Andrew made a bid for the house in Pelham Crescent the day he was shown over it, and Louise's mother came down to London immediately to organize the move.
"Let's hope this does the trick," she said.
Andrew prayed for nothing more. The move from Cheney Walk took about a fortnight, and Louise could still walk only a few paces before she had to sit down. Louise's mother rarely left the house, and Andrew began to feel guilty about how much he was enjoying his new job at the Ministry of Defence. Each night, and then again in the morning, he would try a few words to Louise. She nodded occasionally, touched him once in a while, and even began writing notes to him, but never spoke and never cried. The doctor became even more pessimistic. "The crucial time has passed," he explained. Andrew would sit with her for hours while he worked through the red boxes. Harrier jump jets for the RAF, Polaris missiles for the Royal Navy, Chieftain tanks for the Army. What should Labour's attitude be to Trident when Polaris was phased out? Should we allow crews to be based on British soil? There was so much to learn before he could face the civil servants on their own ground, or the members from the dispatch box. As the months passed, Andrew was always asking questions. A year had gone by, and he was beginning to know some of the answers. He looked up at his wife once again. She was gazing at the portrait of Robert on the mantelpiece. On the anniversary of his son's 6th birthday, Andrew stayed at Pelham Crescent all day with Louise. For the first time, a tear lodged in her eye. As he held her, he kept remembering the lorry. He could see it so clearly now, as if in slow motion. If only the phone hadn't gone. If only the gate had been closed. If only he had turned earlier. If only he had run a little faster. "No goal, Dad. No goal." If only he had scored that goal. Chapter 21. Raymond entered a Washington ablaze with red, white, and blue as the Americans prepared for their bicentennial. He was among the three ministers chosen to represent the United Kingdom when they presented a copy of Magna Carta to the United States Congress. He was making his first trip to America on Concorde, only a few weeks after its inaugural flight. Tom Carson had complained to the House about the expense of the trip, but his words had fallen upon a silent chamber. As the plane taxied to a halt at Dulles Airport, three limousines drew up. The three ministers were given a car each, and motorcycle outriders rushed them to the grounds of the British Embassy on Massachusetts Avenue in less than 30 minutes. Raymond had an immediate love affair with America. Perhaps because it reminded him so much of Kate, with its bubbling enthusiasm, its spirit, and sense of perpetual innovation. During the 10-day visit, he managed to forge several useful contacts in the Senate and the House, and over the weekend, became an unrepentant sightseer of the beautiful Virginia countryside. He concentrated on getting to know those contemporaries whom he felt would be on the American political stage for the next 20 years, while his more senior colleagues dealt with President Ford and his immediate entourage. Raymond enjoyed starting each day with the Washington Post and the New York Times. He quickly learned how to reject those sections that seemed full of endless advertisements for non-essentials he couldn't believe anyone really bought. Once he'd finished reading both papers, he found that he had to wash his hands, as they were always black with newsprint. The one occasion he kept the Outlook section of the Washington Post was when it did profiles on the three ministers from London. He tucked the paper away, as he wanted to show Kate the paragraph that read, "The two secretaries of state are interesting men at the end of their careers, but it is Raymond Gould we should keep our eyes on, because he has the look of a future prime minister." As Raymond flew out of Washington on his way back to London, he presumed, like any lover, that the affair with America could be continued whenever he chose to return.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 6 of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 7. First Among Equals, Cassette 7.
Simon was in Manchester as a guest of the business school when he received Elizabeth's message to call her. It was most unusual for Elizabeth to phone in the middle of the day, and Simon assumed the worst. Something must have happened to the children. The principal of the business school accompanied him to his private office, then left him alone. Dr. Karslake was not at the hospital, he was told, which made him even more anxious. He dialed the Beaufort Street number. Elizabeth picked up the receiver so quickly that she must have been sitting by the phone waiting for him to call.
"I've been sacked," she said.
"What?" said Simon, unable to comprehend.
"I've been made redundant. Isn't that the modern term meant to lessen the blow?
The hospital governors have been instructed by the Department of Health and Social Security to make cutbacks, and three of us in gynecology have lost our jobs. I go at the end of the month."
"Darling, I'm sorry," he said, knowing how inadequate his words must have sounded. "I didn't mean to bother you, but I just wanted someone to talk to," she said. "Everyone else is allowed to complain to their MP, so I thought it was my turn."
"Normally what I do in these circumstances is to put the blame on the Labour Party." Simon was relieved to hear Elizabeth laugh.
"Thanks for ringing me back so quickly, darling. See you tomorrow," she said, and put the phone down.
Simon returned to his group and explained that he had to leave for London immediately. He took a taxi to the airport and caught the next shuttle to Heathrow. He was back at Beaufort Street within 3 hours.
"I didn't mean you to come home,"
Elizabeth said contritely when she saw him on the doorstep.
"I've come to celebrate," Simon said. "Let's open the bottle of champagne that Ronnie gave us when he closed the deal with Morgan Grenfell."
"Why?"
"Because Ronnie taught me one thing. You should always celebrate disasters, not successes."
Simon hung up his coat and went off in search of the champagne. When he returned with the bottle and 2 glasses, Elizabeth asked,
"What's your overdraft looking like nowadays?"
"Down to £16,000, give or take a pound."
"Well, that's another problem, then. I won't be giving any pounds in the future. Only taking."
"Don't be silly. Someone will snap you up," he said, embracing her.
"It won't be quite that easy," said Elizabeth.
"Why not?" asked Simon, trying to sound cheerful.
"Because I'd already been warned about whether I wanted to be a politician's wife or a doctor."
Simon was stunned.
"I had no idea," he said. "I'm so sorry."
"It was my choice, darling,
But I will have to make one or two decisions if I want to remain in medicine, especially if you're going to become a minister.
Simon remained silent. He had always wanted Elizabeth to make this decision herself, and he was determined not to try to influence her.
If only we weren't so short of money.
Don't worry about the money, said Simon.
I do worry, but it may be just an excuse because I worry more about becoming bored when the children have grown up. I just wasn't cut out to be a politician's wife, she added. You should have married someone like Fiona Seymour and you'd be Prime Minister by now.
If that's the only way I can be sure of getting the job, I'll stick with you, said Simon, taking Elizabeth in his arms. Simon couldn't help thinking of all the support his wife had given him during their marriage, and even more so since his financial crisis. He knew exactly what his wife must do. You mustn't be allowed to give up being a doctor, he said. It's every bit as important as wanting to be a minister. Shall I have a word with Jerry Vaughan? As shadow spokesman for health, he might...
Certainly not, Simon. If I'm to get another job, it'll be without anyone doing you or me a favour.
Louise was now coping on her own, and had almost returned to normal life, except she still couldn't speak. She seemed to be self-sufficient within her own world, and the doctor agreed that she no longer needed a full-time nurse. The day the nurse left, Andrew decided to take Louise off for a week's holiday abroad. He wanted to return to the south of France and the Colombe d'Or, but the specialist had advised against it, explaining that any past association might trigger off a memory that in itself could cause a further relapse. Which doctor's mumbo-jumbo, Andrew complained, but nevertheless took her to Venice, not Colombe d'Or. Once there, he was delighted by the interest Louise showed in the beautiful and ancient city. Her eyes lit up at the sight of the Torcello, and she appeared to revel in the trip on a gondola down the twisting waterways past irreplaceable Italian architecture. Again and again she squeezed his hand. As they sat on a piazza for an evening drink, she inclined her head and listened to a quintet playing on St. Mark's Square. Andrew was confident that she could now hear everything he told her. The night before they flew back to England, he woke to find her reading James Morris's Venice, which he had left by his side of the bed. It was the first time she had opened a book since the accident. When he smiled at her, she grinned back. He laughed, wanting to hear her laugh. Andrew returned to the Ministry of Defence on Monday. On his desk, there was a general directive from the Chancellor of the Exchequer requiring the budget estimates for all the big spending departments of state. Andrew fought hard to keep the Polaris missile after being convinced by the Joint Chiefs of its strategic importance to the nation's defence. He was, however, continually reminded by his colleagues in the House that it was party policy to rid themselves of the warmonger's toy. When the Secretary of State returned from Cabinet, he told Andrew, "We've had our way. The Cabinet were impressed by the case, but I can promise you one thing. You won't be the golden boy at this year's party conference."
"It'll make a change for them to even notice me," replied Andrew.
He breathed a sigh of relief while the Joint Chiefs were delighted. But a week later, he lost, by default, the same argument with his own General Purposes Committee in Edinburgh. In his absence, they passed a resolution deploring the retention of the Polaris missile and demanded that all the ministers involved should reconsider their decision. They stopped short of naming Andrew, but everyone knew whose scalp they were after. His case was not helped by Tom Carson making yet another inflammatory speech in the House, claiming that Andrew had been browbeaten by the Joint Chiefs and was nothing more than a Polaris puppet. Andrew's trips to Edinburgh had become less frequent over the past year because of his commitments to Louise and the Defence Department. During the year, three members of his General Management Committee had been replaced with a new group calling themselves Militant Tendency, led by Frank Boyle. It wasn't just Edinburgh Calton that was facing the problem of a left-wing insurgence, as Andrew learned from colleague after colleague. Who was beginning to work out why the left were pushing a resolution at the party conference, proposing that members should be re-selected for each election? Some of his more right-wing colleagues had already been replaced, and it didn't take a wrangler to work out that once a majority of the Trotskyites had secured places on his management committee, Andrew could be removed at their whim, whatever his past experience or record. Whenever Andrew was in Edinburgh, the local people continually assured him of their support and their confidence in him. But he could not forget, despite their avowals, that it would still take only a handful of votes to remove him. Andrew feared what the outcome would be if many other members were facing the same problem as he faced in Edinburgh.
Dad, can I have a new cricket bat, please?
What's wrong with the old one? Asked Simon as they came out of the house.
It's too small,
he said, waving it around as if it were an extension to his arm. It'll have to do, I'm afraid.
But Martin Henderson's dad has given him a new bat to start the season.
I'm sorry, Peter. The truth is that Martin's father is far better off than I am.
I tell you one thing, said Peter with feeling. I'm sure not going to be an MP when I grow up.
Simon smiled as his son removed an old cricket ball from his trouser pocket and tossed it over to his father.
Anyway, bet you can't get me out even though I've only got a small bat.
Don't forget we still have the junior-sized stumps left over from last year, said Simon, so it'll be just as hard to hit them.
Stop making excuses, Dad. Just admit you're past it.
Simon burst out laughing. We'll see, he said with more bravado than conviction. Simon always enjoyed a few overs in the garden against his elder son, although at the age of 13 Peter was already able to play his best deliveries with a confidence that was beginning to look ominous. It was several overs before Simon removed Peter's middle stump and took his turn at the crease. Michael ran out of the house to join them in the field, and Simon couldn't help noticing that he was wearing a pair of jeans that were far too short and had once belonged to Peter.
Get behind the wicket, Nipper,
shouted Peter at his 11-year-old brother,
because that's where most of the balls will be going.
Michael happily obeyed without comment. A colleague in the house had recently warned Simon that by 14 they began to beat you, and by 16 they hoped not to show they weren't trying their hardest any longer. Simon gritted his teeth as he watched his elder son's fastest ball safely onto the middle of the bat. The way he was going, Peter wouldn't have to wait much longer before he could clean bowl him. He managed to keep his wicket intact for a further 5 minutes before he was rescued by Elizabeth, who came out to tell them that supper was ready.
What, hamburger and chips again?
Said Michael, as his mother put a plate in front of him.
You're lucky to get anything,
Elizabeth snapped back. Simon cursed again at the damage his own selfish greed had brought upon his family, and marvelled at how little they all complained. He said nothing, only too aware that the previous day Elizabeth had completed her last week at the hospital and was already missing St. Mary's.
How did you all get on?
She asked cheerily.
I'll survive,
said Simon, still thinking about his overdraft. Once the Chancellor had presented his mini-budget in November 1976, the long process of the Finance Bill, confirming all the new measures proposed, fully occupied the House. Charles, although not a member of the front bench finance team, regularly took the lead among backbenchers on clauses on which he had specialist knowledge. He and Clive Reynolds studied the new finance bill meticulously, and between them picked out the 7 clauses that would have an adverse effect on banking. Reynolds guided Charles through each clause, suggesting changes, rewording, and on some occasions presenting an argument for deleting whole sections of the bill. Charles learned quickly, and was soon adding his own ideas. One or two even made Clive Reynolds reconsider. After Charles had put forward amendments to the House on three of the clauses, both front benches became respectfully attentive whenever he rose to present a case. One morning, after the government's defeat on a clause relating to banking loans, he received a note of congratulation from Margaret Thatcher. The clause Charles most wanted to see removed from the bill concerned a client's right to privacy when dealing with a merchant bank. The Shadow Chancellor was aware of Charles's specialized knowledge on this subject and invited him to oppose Clause 110 from the front bench. Charles realized that if he could defeat the government on this clause, he might be invited to join the Shadow Finance team in the run-up to the general election. Judging by the Chairman of Ways and Means' selection of amendments, the Whips estimated that Clause 110 on banking privacy would be reached sometime on Thursday afternoon. On Thursday morning, Charles rehearsed his arguments thoroughly with Clive Reynolds, who only had one or two minor amendments to add before Charles set off for the House. When he arrived at the Commons, there was a note on the message board asking him to phone the Shadow Chancellor urgently. "The government are going to accept a Liberal amendment tabled late last night," the Shadow Chancellor told him. "Why?" said Charles. "Minimum change is what they're really after, but it gets them off the hook and at the same time keeps the Liberal vote intact. In essence, nothing of substance has changed, but you'll need to study the wording carefully. Can I leave you to handle the problem?" "Certainly," said Charles, pleased with the responsibility with which they were now entrusting him. He walked down the long corridor to the vote office and picked up the sheet with Clause 110 on it and the proposed Liberal amendment. He read them both through half a dozen times before he started to make notes. Parliamentary counsel, with their usual expertise, had produced an ingenious amendment. Charles ducked into a nearby phone booth and rang Clive Reynolds at the bank. Charles dictated the amendment over the phone to him, and then remained silent while Reynolds considered its implications. "Clever bunch of sharpies. It's a cosmetic job, but it won't change the power it invests in the government one iota. Were you thinking of returning to the bank? That would give me time to work on it." "No," said Charles. "Are you free for lunch?" Clive Reynolds checked his diary. A Belgian banker would be lunching in the boardroom, but his colleagues could handle that. "Yes, I'm free." "Good," said Charles. "Why don't you join me at White's around 1 o'clock? "Thank you," said Reynolds. "By then I should have had enough time to come up with some credible alternatives." Charles spent the rest of the morning rewriting his speech, which he hoped would counter the Liberal argument and make them reconsider their position. If it met with Reynolds's imprimatur, the day could still be his. He read through the clause once more, convinced he had found a way through the loophole the civil servants couldn't block. He placed his speech and the amended clause in his inside pocket and went down to the members' entrance and jumped into a waiting taxi. As the cab drove up St. James's, Charles thought he saw his wife coming down the opposite side of the road. He pushed down the window to be sure, but she had disappeared into Prunier's. He wondered with which of her girlfriends she was lunching. The cab travelled on up St. James's and came to a halt outside White's. Charles found he was a few minutes early, so he decided to walk down to Prunier's and ask Fiona if she would like to come to the house after lunch and hear him oppose the clause. Reaching the restaurant, he glanced through the pane glass window. He froze on the spot. Fiona was chatting at the bar with a man whose back was to Charles, but he thought he recognized his profile, although he couldn't be certain. He noticed that his wife was wearing a dress he had never seen before. He didn't move as he watched a waiter bow, then guide the pair toward a corner table, where they were conveniently out of sight. Charles's first instinct was to march straight in and confront them, but he remained outside. For what seemed an interminable time, he stood alone, uncertain what to do next. Finally, he crossed back over St. James's Street and stood in the doorway of the Economist building, going over several plans. In the end, he decided to do nothing but wait. He stood there so cold and so incensed that he did not consider returning